I first came into contact with Amy Kress Rosenthal's work when I took over the coordination of KarmaTube in the spring of 2011 and got to see her, what was called the thought bubble on kindness. That video, which KarmaTube titled, How Do You Want to Be Remembered? Taken from one of the thought bubble video, was a video of the week in May 2010 with a wonderful message about kindness. I got to see several other short films which all made it onto KarmaTube, including Poetry, P-O-E-T, Tree, showing people hanging poems on a bare tree in the middle of winter with handwritten poems fluttering in the wind like leaves, and Graffiti, G-R-A-F-E-E-T-I, where Amy slips inspirational notes into random shoes. Then there were the videos of Amy's Beck and Lovely series, which started out as an unplanned flash mob on 80808 at 8:08 p.m. Amy is also a best-selling author. She's written 25 children's books and journals and books for adults, a radio blogger, and TEDx speaker. Amy's memoir, Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, made it into NPR's list of best books of 2010. We've invited Amy to share her prescriptions for life, including ATM, Always Trust Magic, and Make the Most of Your Time Here on the call today. So welcome, Amy, and it's a real pleasure to finally speak with you.
Oh, thank you so much. Glad to be here, and thank you for that introduction.
So I wanted to start out with just a basic question about how your journey began on this rather unusual trajectory. What was the impetus of simply putting your ideas into projects and then out into the world?
Such a fair and simple question. And how to answer that? Let's see. You know, maybe the most honest response would be not doing it was something that I didn't know how to not do those things. And I have, from the beginning of, this part of my career, because I did have a different career for 10 years out of college, I started writing and making, you know, these videos and doing all the stuff that you spoke about. That started about 15 years ago. And I have just always tried to create the things that I feel most compelled to create as a result of always having a hyper-awareness of the amount of time any of us are given on this earth. Since my earliest years, my parents would tease me that I was kind of morbid as a kid and always saying, like, come on, we got to do this. We don't have much time. And I was, like, 6 years old. So I've always taken that into my work, that I, whether I'm writing a book or creating a film project, it's really the thing that I am feeling passionate about at that moment, and just trying to stay true to that.
What was your earlier job?
I was in advertising. I for 10 years out of school, I worked, I wrote commercials. So that was I loved it. It was what I wanted to do. Towards the end of college, I figured out it was kind of the career that I was after. It seemed to be the perfect combination of making things and having fun. And I did not think that I was going to grow up to be a writer, such as I am, I suppose, now. I didn't see that until later. So I was really excited and committed about trying to break into the advertising world, and it was wonderful. It suited me well, and I had a fantastic 10 years in that world. But then somehow one day it was just over. I was on maternity leave with my third child, and I just had this kind of little mini epiphany that I wasn't going to go back to my job, and I wanted to write.
That's great. Thank you so much for the background, Amy. I love your credo, always trust magic, and let me tell you, it's a powerful one for me in my life right now. It seems that a large part of that trust may also be about checking your inhibitions at the door. Do you ever have doubts or second thoughts about what you do, or have you learned to trust your inspiration completely?
For someone who makes a life out of putting things out there in the world, you know, books or whatever it is, projects, I think that you develop early on, just out of necessity, a bit of a, I don't want to say shield, because I don't feel like I'm shielding myself from anything exactly, but it's more that those things don't matter as much. Do I doubt myself? Sure. I mean, you know, I have a small group of people that I might share some work in progress with and say, you know, is this feeling right to you? Do you like this? Does this look like the thing that I'm trying to express? So, you know, it's not like I can sit down to write and I just love what I'm doing all the time. That is, of course, not the case. But in terms of, like, once something is kind of whole and out there, whether it is, like, an official book or a video I'm putting out or any number of endeavors, I try not to worry about the emotions that would be around that, because I feel like I'm just connected to making the thing, and that's the most important thing. The other day I was speaking at an event, and somebody asked me a similar question about rejections, because I spoke about breaking into the business. I had a lot of rejections, and I still have those, right? I'll submit a book idea, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be accepted. So everything I write doesn't get published. And so they were kind of going along that line, you know, how do you not doubt yourself? How do you deal with the rejection? And the truth is, and I wonder if this will make sense to you guys, I had never quite articulated it before like this, but there's a relief, like, there's not that much of a distance between when something doesn't work and it gets rejected, or I can tell that it's just not working. Let's just keep it clean. If when I get a rejection letter or notice from an editor, let's say, versus when I get accepted, if a book is going to be accepted, it doesn't affect my day that much one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm happier when I find out, yes, this book is going to be published. Okay, of course that feels better. But when I get the no, it doesn't, like, bowl me over. My day isn't ruined. So I still I'm going on doing whatever I'm doing, regardless if I get that yes or the no.
Mm-hmm. Let me just follow up quickly, though. What about for those spontaneous things you do, like the meeting on 80808? Was that something you fretted about, or you just thought, oh, I'm just going to do it?
Well, with that first one, I had no idea that the kind of response that was, you know, when you watch the video and you see all the hundreds of the people that showed up, I did not anticipate that at all. I did not have those kinds of expectations. That was my very first kind of gathering of its kind for me. It was sort of even pre, doing these I wasn't even calling it a flash mob, because that term hadn't even really been coined or wasn't popular exactly in the summer of 2008. It was right on the cusp of that. That term was starting. I was just doing this thing that I wanted to do. And I thought I'd be happy if, like, 50 people came. That I would be thrilled if, like, 30 or 50 people came. I thought that was just really what was going to happen. So when it was a big group, it was exciting and exhilarating, and oh my gosh, and it was super fun, and it really was a highlight of my creative life that evening, and what transpired there, and the project that came from that night, and it lasted all the way through you know, last winter. But so, no, for that, I just wanted to do this thing. In the subsequent gatherings for the Beckoning of Lovely project, when there was expectation behind it, the project gained some momentum. You know, on my, let's say, 11-11-11 gathering, yeah, I was worried, like, you know, this better work, and I know people are hoping it's going to work, and there's going to be a good amount of people there, and I don't want it to, you know, disappoint them. So those kinds of feelings grew as the project grew.
Thank you.
Amy, I want to ask you on a slightly different topic. I noticed that a lot of your work, in a lot of your work, you categorize things. Like in your TED Talk, Seven Notes on Life, you start with A and go through G. Your memoir is an encyclopedic form, A to Z. Have you always thought like that, or where does that come from?
I have. I like to, you know, the world's a big, messy place. And for me, in my creative process, I find solace in creating these structures that anchor my work in some way, because I do have a tendency to want to say a lot of different and possibly disparate things, like a collection of random thoughts that might be woven together versus a linear narrative. You know, a traditional with ABC, the arc, you know, that kind of thing. So if I'm going to create something, whether it's a talk like you mentioned or my book, The Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, those things happen because I was saying multiple things, and I always do feel a responsibility to organize the material in such a way that it won't be overwhelming to the listener or the reader. And I also feel that it's more responsible as the creator to, like, when I was thinking about making the Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, and I had all these different ideas, different observations and writings and paragraphs and thoughts, I knew that I couldn't put it together as just a big, you know, dump it into a document and say, here's a book. That's not finished, and that's not right. It needed more. I knew that intuitively. So I searched for the structure for a long time, many, many months. The encyclopedia idea didn't occur to me until pretty far into the project. But so that structure is both necessity and also, I think I probably just have fun finding those devices.
That's a great way to conceptualize it. I think you're right. There can be so much that seems random, but there really is some sort of inherent structure. I had the wonderful opportunity to look at some of your children's books. They are absolutely delightful. How do you get the inspiration for those?
Oh, you know, I love to make things. What can I say? I love to make things. It's all connected in the course of the day. The children's books, the grown-up things, whether it's a book, a video, a project idea, the inspiration it's everywhere for me. It's how it feels. So when you say, like, how do I get it for the children's book? Sometimes I have an idea for something, and I don't know what it is yet. I don't know. Is this a children's book idea? Is this a video? Is this the start of maybe an adult book? Like, I may not even know what the thing is till I really stay with it for some time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the most accurate way to answer that question.
Yeah.
You know, Amy, you have something like 25 books with different illustrators. How do you choose your collaborators, you know, both for the books and for other projects? Is there something specific you
want? Well, that's a good question. I love collaborating, and in the world of children's books, it is strangely accepted and standard that the writer and the illustrator do not really work together. Once a writer hands in the manuscript or the manuscript's accepted, it is, again, you know, standard form. The editor then takes over and chooses the illustrator, and the writer will probably see the book in its finished form when the book is published. That is often how it's done, with essentially no interaction between the writer and the illustrator. Well, if that sounds a little bit confusing to you, it did to me when I started out. And because I think of my advertising background, where you are paired, writers and art directors work together. That's the paradigm in the business. You collaborate from, you know, that's just the way it is. There's two people working together all the time. That is a model that really I think works well, and I love it. So fortunately, the beginning of my book career, after all those rejections that I mentioned a few minutes ago, when I got those first my editor at this first publishing house, Chronicle Books, was really amenable to my involvement with an illustrator. So from the get-go, I was allowed, thankfully, to look at, you know, portfolios and have a discussion with her about who might illustrate this book. It was Little P. My first book, children's book, was Little P. And we chose Jen together, and from there, that has been a way that I've worked for most of my books. And at this point, this transcends to different publishing houses and different editors as well. And I'm really grateful and happy about that. I find that it's really crucial to the process for me in bringing a book to life. Now, that's not to say that the way that it is, the standard way that I described, is not necessarily broken. It works for a lot of people and for, you know, millions of books, but it doesn't work so well for me.
Now, I want to move on to one of your adult books that's categorized in your journals section. Can you talk about karma checks, and particularly about the bad karma checks?
That's funny that you're bringing that up. See, sometimes this goes to the thing about making things, that I like to just make things and I don't always know what they are. So as a person who's sort of known for writing books, I do have these random little products out in the world, such as karma checks. And it looks like a checkbook, right? So, and it's got good and bad karma checks in there that you can hand out to people. Let's see, you want me to talk about some of the bad ones?
I know that it would be really easy for me to hand out a good karma check. I think that we in the service space ecosystem do this all the time. We thank people, we give them smile cards to pay for it, an act of kindness, et cetera, et cetera. The bad karma checks are something that I don't think I would be comfortable doing. So I just wanted to ask you whether, you know, how you thought about those, and how you've seen these being used, if you've gotten any feedback.
You know, it's so interesting. I don't think I've ever been asked about these cards exactly. In some ways, I think that I don't even know if anybody would use the bad karma checks. I think you're right. Like, here's the first one. How could you litter like that? Personally, I'm stunned, and I just want you to know that next time I'd rather you hand your trash to me than drop it on the ground. And then you sign it, right? Well, I don't think anybody's going to really hand that to a person who litters. I think it's maybe more, it's almost like a little mini book in this checkbook form, right? Because I know that I wouldn't hand it out either. So in some ways, it's a conceptual piece. It's a piece of writing that acts like a checkbook and acts like something that you might really use. But at the end of the day, I think for many of these, I do wonder how many folks that bought this carry it around in their purse and actually hand these things out versus, you know, it's just a fun item of commentary on life that you might keep on your desk or on your coffee table.
Right. That sounds like fun. I've got to find those. We still have more questions for you, Amy, and I know our callers will too, but I do want to afford you the time to share with us some new projects that you're working on. What would you like to talk about? What would you like to share with us?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. Well, I did notice that I'll tell you about a new book I have out and a new video project that I'm working on. But first, I'll tell you something that excited me a few days ago, which is going on this, back to the subject of I'm a person who likes to make things. I think that's the most accurate label of all, that I just like to make things. I was looking at the word maker, M-A-K-E-R, and on my website it actually says my name, and instead of a title like author, you know, writer, filmmaker, it doesn't say that. It just says I'm a person who likes to make things. So you'd think that I would have figured this out a long time ago, but it was just the other day that I noticed maker is an anagram for me, AKR. And, I mean, that was just like the greatest thing ever. I was so thrilled. So I'm really excited about that. Okay, and then I suppose I should say I have a new children's book out. It's called Exclamation Mark. It's the story of a exclamation mark, of course, who has grown up in a sea of periods, and he doesn't understand why he is like he is. They don't mind how he is. It's more his own thing. He's trying to figure out what his deal is and why he is, you know, full of energy like this. And it's his quest to find out what he's about and what he's here to do. And I'm especially excited about this book. Because it was many years in the making. I had the story about 6 years ago, and it took a long time to really gel and gestate into its current full form. And it was inspired by one of my children, who it occurred to me one day, just sort of out of the blue, that he was an exclamation mark. So you were asking before about my inspiration. I usually can't tell where a book idea comes from. It's just anywhere. But with this one, it's very specifically inspired by my child. And so, yeah, and it's a collaboration with Tom Lichtenheld, who I love working with. We've done quite a few books together, and he's just incredible. And it's, yeah, it's just been out for a couple weeks. And I should also say that it's a children's book, but it's also kind of got an adult message. So it's going to be marketed also like as a graduation kind of book, like, oh, the places you'll go kind of thing. So you might see it again in May around that season. And then the video project that I think your group might, well, hopefully might like, is called The Mending Machine Project, playing off Vending Machine. And it's a collaboration with a woman named Lee Redmond, who I've worked with before. If you've seen the Beckoning of Lovely series, she's the one who created the tiny little letters, those, you know, one-inch little letters that were handed out at the 10-10-10 event. And she's an artist in Oakland, California, does beautiful work. I encourage everybody to check her out. And so what this project is, we have created, I think it's 9 different little packages that we will be leaving on and inside vending machines. And let's see, I have them right here. For example, there's a little package and it's got sandpaper in it, and it says, going through a rough patch, this sandpaper is for you. And then on the back it says, if this found you at just the right time, we would love to hear from you. We wish you well, Amy and Leah, and it's mendingmachine.com. Here's one that's got a little piece of duct tape inside. Broken heart, this duct tape is for you. This one is got a tiny little super glue inside, and it says shattered dream. This super glue is for you. And well, I'll read one more. This one just has a little Band-Aid, and it says, are your feelings hurt? This Band-Aid is for you. And she packaged them really beautifully. We have a little logo and sticker that she designed, and it says, the mending machine offering a wee and free bit of existential nourishment.
That's beautiful. So all of these things that you make, one on your website, you mentioned two things that you like to make that intrigued me. One of the other ones were fairly obvious, like books and videos and wishes. But the two that intrigued me was connecting with the universe and salads. So can you talk a little bit about these two things, and are they related in any way?
Connecting with the universe and salads, are they related? Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh.
Oh, gosh. Well, let's start with salads because that's easy. Somewhere along the way, I got recognized for my salad-making abilities. I can't say that I'm, like, the best chef in the world, and I'm not a baker. I mean, I've raised a family, so I know my way around the kitchen, but I don't think anybody would say I'm exceptional. But for some reason, I can make a good salad, and I make a lot of homemade dressings. So that's sort of my thing. Like, people remember from my dinner parties is a salad or, you know, any big family gathering. I'm always the one who's asked to bring the salad. So what can I tell you? I can make a decent salad. If we're in the same city, I'll make one for you.
All right.
Okay, so that's that. And then the connections with the universe. This has been a theme in my work from day one. And I don't know why. I'm not sure it matters why. But even pre-internet, because I was making stuff before there was even an internet. Can we remember that even? I was doing stuff, writing magazine pieces where I would ask the reader a question and invite them to respond via a P.O. box. I had a P.O. box down the street, and I did a lot of interactive stuff that way in my first writings. So it's been incredibly fortuitous and just grand for me to happen to be a person making things in the era of the internet, because, of course, the interaction, the connecting with the universe is unlike any other time ever, right? I mean, that's what half the beauty of the internet is. So I was doing these things forever and waiting for, you know, a letter in the P.O. box or that kind of a dialogue, and then there was email, of course. And it just changed everything for me, as evidenced by, you know, the Beckoning of Lovely. That whole thing was through a YouTube video, and the invitation to come was through a YouTube video. And so connecting with the universe, there's just such a wonderful sandbox for that now. And I love it in all its forms. I started something a couple months ago called a text letter, where people can sign up for like a weekly personal little text from me, because I found I can do it, you know, with my phone. I set up a different number. It's not exactly my personal cell phone, but it was easy to do. So all these interactions with the universe, I don't know. I gravitate towards it, and I dig it.
Mm. That's interesting. You know, it's almost like you were there and then had to wait for technology to catch up to you. But I'm wondering, you know, given this this amazing gift, this magnetism, creativity that you have, what would you say are the ingredients that go into making you Amy Krauss-Rosenthal? childhood, spiritual, educational. What went into making you who you are today?
Oh my gosh. I was I think I've been given a nice amount of support and encouragement and freedom, combination of those things probably between my childhood and my adulthood, and from I guess the adults in both of those arenas that were responsible for that, I would say early on, of course, my parents. I was asked this recently too. I didn't grow up in like a super creative household. You know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, my parents were fostering this in the biggest way, and we sat around coloring all day together, and everything was super creative. And, you know, of course, that's not what happened. Just for those people that think they need to provide that nonstop for their kids if they're going to grow up to work in the arts, I don't believe that. I think to some degree we are who we are from the beginning. But what my parents did give me, I just had a wonderful childhood. I'm the oldest of four. And it was just a very typical 70s childhood. And my parents gave me, you know, endless love and all that good, important, valuable stuff. And in terms of what I'm doing now, your question directly, they allowed me to do that stuff and encouraged it in just the right amount. Like, I wasn't pushed, and it wasn't, like, a big thing, but, like, my favorite birthday present ever was a shoebox that they filled with all kinds of craft stuff because they know that I loved it. It's just like that, you know? Just, and I remember that present, and I talk about it a lot. It was, like, the best present ever. So that's that. And then on the other end, I would say my husband has really... I feel like I might have been a writer or a creator, whether or not I met and married him, but I wouldn't be this particular creator. And my relationship with him is, I think, gives me the peace of mind and the freedom to do the things that I want to do in just the way that I want to do them. And I think it's because of his support and the way he is with me that I am able to create like this.
That sounds great. It sounds, it just sounds like you're really very, very open, and things just kind of can happen to you.
Well, and I'm happy to, you know, on the next service call, we can talk about, you know, all the dead ends and the rejections and the things that don't work out and all the troubles and, you know, the blacker, darker stuff. I don't want your listeners to think like it's all just perfectly groovy every second of the day. I'm here, you know, making my stuff and never have any hiccups. So that's not the reality. I assume that everybody would assume that, but I just want to be clear on that, right? You know, yes, I love what I do, and I'm able to do it. But it doesn't mean that there aren't inherent struggles, right? So,
well, Amy, I think we'll probably be going to the question and answer pretty soon, but would you mind just elaborating on some of the challenges that you faced? Just maybe give us a preview.
Let's see, what challenges? Well, like I said, I mean, at the book release party for my very first book, which came out in 1998, I had on the table a binder full of all the rejection letters. And when I say binder, it was a binder. It wasn't a little thin folder. It was a binder. So, you know, it took a while to even get anybody to say yes to me doing this stuff, right? And I don't want to repeat myself because we already talked about, like, it was more of a nuisance, that stuff. It didn't deter me because I knew I wanted to do this. But, you know, really in hindsight, I look back, I don't even know how I kept going. Like, that was a lot of rejections. It was ridiculous. and let's just say raising a family, and my children are getting towards grown now. My youngest is 16, my oldest is 20. But when I was starting out, they were, toddlers. So even just constructing my day in such a way that allowed me to do the work, is tricky. And, there's little kids running around and this one's sick. And, I have memories of trying to, being at some big event and getting a call that, I got to go pick one of my kids up. I mean, just all that kind of just mundane stuff. There's plenty of that. And I don't know, we can go on and on, but that gives you an idea.
Talking about your family and things like that, you have a very cute story in your kindness thought bubble about marrying who you did. Can you talk a little bit about how you knew that that person in the thrift store was going to be your husband?
Okay, so, here's the thing. People think, if you watch the video again, now I can see how people think that what I meant was that I saw this stranger and I married him, and I didn't realize when I was writing it that people would interpret that that's exactly what it was. The wording is such that it could also mean, which is the truth, is that I was on my, fifth date with him there. And so, yes, I ended up marrying him, but I didn't meet him in the thrift store. So, it never occurred to me that that's how people would interpret it, but many people do. So here's the thing, which actually helps validate the whole story. So, yes, I had only known him a short time. We were in the thrift shop. He went to go fold this blanket for help a stranger fold a blanket. I was like, oh, my God, this is, the nicest person ever. I was just so blown away by it. It wasn't a showy gesture at all. And it's so true to him. It's exactly who he is. He's quietly stellar. And, but I knew this about him before the thrift shop. I knew this within 4 seconds of opening my door on the blind date where I met him. I opened the door and I knew that he was the one. So by the fifth date at the thrift shop, that was just cementing things.
So the universe provided on your blind date.
I'm sorry?
The universe provided.
Yeah, I don't know. There he was. There's one thing also, I know we're going to get to the Q&A again in a moment, but when I was thinking about this talk and going over my notes and, what the mission that we're, the Venn diagram that we all share, the middle space of whatever, trying to sort of put good out there in the world, the language of, changing the world, I've been thinking about that a lot lately, and so maybe this is something that the Q&A can work both ways. I can ask this of the group. So this is language that we use, right? We're going to change the world. We're going to do something wonderful that's going to change the world. And I couldn't figure out what was rubbing me the wrong way about the exact wording of this. It started to feel confusing to me the last couple years, and I realized that I'm not sure I feel that that is the best way to describe how I feel. I'm not looking to change the world. That feels like there's a few people that do that maybe in the history of mankind, but I think when you say let's change the world, it implies that the world is extraordinarily lacking and broken, and I think there's already so much good in the world. Of course, there's plenty of, horrid as well, but I look at it as maybe our role is to enhance the world, And when you shift the word from change to enhance, it feels, A, a little bit less overwhelming, and B, a little more respectful. Like, yeah, there's good stuff going on here. My job while we're here is to enhance, make it better. And I wonder if that resonates for any of you.
I think that is a perfect lead-in to our Q&A. And again, if there is any sort of resonance with Amy's proposed question, please do respond as well. It looks like we already have our first caller.
Me, this is Bella. Thanks so much for sharing with us this morning. I'm really looking forward to reading your book, especially the one about the exclamation point. I'm thinking about the question you just put out there, and that's in the back of my mind. But before I get to that, I was just listening to you throughout the call and thinking about your incredible creativity. I can feel that through the ideas that you've shared and reading more about you. And then I had this image of this huge binder filled with rejection letters, on your table. And I want to know how all those rejection letters didn't make you lose faith in your unique creativity and what in this gift that you wanted to offer. And was that also in any way connected to this, connection you feel with the universe?
I really don't know why the no's don't bother me as much as they should have. I can't really explain it other than I feel the most like myself when I am making things, okay? Like, honestly, that I know about myself. I'm happy if I have a pen in my hand. My hand feels right. Like, just the way my hands are, I feel better if there's a pen in my hand. When I'm not making things for a couple days, I can feel it in myself. I'm always like, why am I feeling a little bit out of sorts or grumpy? Oh, yeah, I haven't been able to create for a couple days. And it's so at this point, I know that enough about myself that is my best resting state is to be creating. So maybe in some ways I just have been trying to, I knew that that's where I needed to be without intellectualizing it too much. I just why do we like certain flavors? We like these flavors, so we eat them. We know this about ourselves. And there's a great Annie Dillard story. The writer Annie Dillard talks about somebody asking her if they thought she could be a writer, and she said, "I don't know. Do you like sentences?" And that really works for me. I really love sentences. I need to spend my life around sentences. So whatever it takes, I'm gonna make it happen.
That sounds great. Just let me toss out a quick question here for you. It's a little random, but you're married, you have three kids. How would your family describe what it's like to live with you, or how would your family describe what it is like to be your family?
I think that I think in a lot of ways we're a regular house, and I'm mom, and this is what they've grown up with. And yes, they recognize what I do, and certainly every year as they get older and older, are having an understanding of it in a different way, other than it's just, oh, that's mom's thing. And, they're used to seeing manuscripts on the kitchen table, and I'll ask them to read stuff. So, this is, whatever it is that you grow up with is what you think is the norm. So I'm not sure that they would say to you anything super, revealing or fascinating. Like, oh yeah, it's what they know. I don't know. Does that make sense?
I mean, I'm sure it does. I guess I was just wondering, since it's not, you know, typical for people to, you know, go out and do the Beck and Lovely thing or those.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know,
I know that's
what
true.
Does your mom do? She works in insurance, you know.
yeah. No, it's you're right. Like they're, and you know, at the last big gathering, like, you know, half their school came to it and teachers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a combination of, like, they kind of like it, and then sometimes they don't. Maybe it's completely a combination of, yeah, this is what she does, and, like, it's maybe a little bit interesting, or there she goes again, what's she doing? and then, you know, sometimes not even really noticing, right? I mean, they're teenagers, like, they're in their world. Like, I joke that sometimes they think that I don't work because they can, like, I can have a whole day of, like, stuff and even have, like, a huge event or whatnot, but they come home at 5 o'clock and here I am making dinner, you know. Yeah, no, my mom was just home waiting for me to get home.
And I thought I'd take this opportunity to respond to you, Amy, in regard to sort of your perspective on not saying necessarily changing the world, but enhancing the world. It actually reminded me of a quote that someone just sent me recently about how, you know, when we see the world as broken, we try to fix it. And when we see the world as weak, we try to help it. But when we see the world as whole, then we try to serve it.
Really nice.
It changes the entire tone and approach to it. And I think that, you know, for a while I used to be one of those, oh, let me fix the world type persons, or let me help, and I realized that in those efforts I was the one that actually needed fixing. I was the one that actually needed help. And
what's that from? What's the quote from?
Oh, you know, it was just a friend of mine. She was writing, I mean, I don't know what the quote she pulled it on, but she had quoted it in an essay, but it was just sort of attributed to Anonymous. And so, you know, but like I said, I was just sort of thinking about that for myself and how I used to be or wanted to be the fixer or the helper, and I was the one that needed sort of fixing and helping, and how... When you look at, like you said, some of the individuals in history who's really made an impact, like a Gandhi, for example, he's an individual that didn't really necessarily, even though it might have seemed like it outwardly, that he was trying to change, say, India or the Hello? British Empire or whatnot. It was really him changing himself. And mm-hmm. that's sort of been sort of the way that I've sort of taken a look or tried to focus that. And so just wanted to kind of put that out there.
That's really
and
nice.
I am, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and put it to our next caller.
Hi, this is Michelle in Santa Fe. And thank you for asking the question about changing the world. You've helped me wake up again and got me a little bit more engaged from the medical stuff I've been dealing with back to what my life is about. And for many years I've been exploring what I have come to call transformational global leadership, and it's exactly that question. I have a background as a linguist, and what I found is that we really don't have a good way to language that. And after a lot of years of trying to fix the world, change the world, teach other people how to do it, leading workshops, coaching people in transformational global leadership, what I have come to is that there's an experience that people can get into, like the Gandhis, the Martin Luther King, that have a certain kind of relationship to the world and what's happening. And when we're in that particular experience of the world, then we have access to capacities that we don't have otherwise. And we don't have good language for it. One way sometimes I could language it is to engage the world, or even more, to be the world, because in that world it seems like there's a connection that is so profound that there is only an awareness of existence. There is no awareness of me and the world that needs changing.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a touch on that. And if you'd ever like to talk more about it, I'd love to talk to you about it further.
That's really, yeah, I love that. Be the world.
That's great. I'm going to turn it back to Yumi and to Jen. I think we have a little bit of time for a few more questions.
Okay. Yumi, do you have one?
Well, you know, I'd also like to respond to your question to us about how we see the world. You know, do we want to change it or do we want only small things with great love? And all of us at Service Space, you know, are one of the three principles we work with is do small things. And I think that has helped us in not seeing this change the world as such a big thing. You know, we change the world around us. We change the world sort of within the reach of our arms. And what we try and put out there with all of our services, like the Daily Goods and the Karma Tubes and the Help Others sites with the smile cards, is just do small things. And you know, everyone can be a hero. And think of yourself as someone who can actually make a difference in somebody's life. So perhaps I think you are very right. For most people, change the world is really a sort of an impossible thing. But your languaging really does help. And
what about, though, even with the small things you're saying, which I believe wholeheartedly in, is it still changing? And I don't have the answer. I mean this sincerely, like, because it's really, feels really interesting to me. If you do those things, is it about changing the world around you? Is that what we mean?
You know, I'm not sure it's about changing the world, because that's such a, as you say, that's such a loaded phrase. I think what we mean is making someone's life better.
Right.
Being kind to somebody and, you know, making their day or their moment just that little bit better. And maybe just change their life. But we don't really look to see it that way. We just look to see it as doing that small thing that, you know, has an impact. But it is it is it's a good thing to ponder. And I think it's probably worth many essays.
I'd be excited to think about what you know, new three-word mantra we could, you know, create. What is it? I don't know.
So I actually have a question for you based on something that I read by the NPR correspondent or guest who named your memoir one of the best books of 2010, and she mentioned that you had an inspired way of attempting to get out of a parking ticket. So I wonder if you would share that with us, or do we have to buy the book?
Oh, no, I'm happy to. Let's see, I can grab the heading, but it was essentially I pleaded if I could get off of the ticket on the grounds of good karma, going back to that word. I got a parking ticket, and I had been shopping for gifts for people. And it just came out like a couple minutes late from the store. So, I mean, I honestly, literally was like, you know, getting gifts for people. And so I came out and I got the ticket. I thought, well, this is not right, you know. And I thought, what the heck, I'll just write the letter. And so in the book, I share the letter that I wrote to them. and I actually had a petition, and I had people sign, a few people sign it. And do you want me to, like, read part of that letter?
Sure.
Okay. Dear City of Chicago, Department of Revenue, and Police Officer S. Weathers, I know you say there are only 7 grounds for contesting a violation notice, but I just want to be honest with you and see if the following might also be considered a temporary eighth ground. On Friday, October 6th, I went to Barnes & Noble on Diversity. I was there before the store even opened. Another gentleman and myself were there waiting for them to open the doors at 9 a.m., but I didn't get his name. Anyway, I went to buy books to give as gifts, and I had many occasions coming up that called for a gift, and then I outlined all the gifts that I bought, which were 6 different things. I did buy a cup of coffee at the Starbucks cafe inside. I felt I deserved that, but besides that, the rest of my purchases were for other people. I rushed around the best I could and thought I could get everything in less than an hour. Bottom line, I misjudged the amount of time it would take, but in light of the reason for my visit and that it was only a couple minutes past the expired time, I was wondering if you could extend to me a small break, like a good karma kind of thing. And then I included a check for the 25 cents that I had owed the meter and the petition. And I got a letter about a month later, and I got off the ticket.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
That was fun.
That sounds like a great story. I wonder if that's possible to do for speeding tickets while you're driving.
Oh, yeah. I was rushing to go see my grandmother.
That's fantastic. Amy, it looks like we're getting here to sort of the end of the call. I did have one question for you that I wanted to throw out at you. And, you know, and this is something that has come up for me personally, and I think for a number of others, that, you know, when you're engaging in some of these small acts of kindness or leaving notes or treats or whatnot, and there's an inner fun to it or whatnot, but often, you know, there are moments, and maybe consider call it a darker moment or whatnot, where you might have to ask yourself, like, am I doing this robotically? Why do I keep doing this? I guess, how do you tap into your authenticity or to maintain that authenticity when you are, whether it's writing all of these children's books or doing some of these acts or even just talking about this stuff, whether it's to a crowd like us or to another audience? How do you maintain your authenticity?
What can I say? You know, what I'm doing, this, I wouldn't even use the word, because it's like if you say to the fish, how's the water? And the fish says, what water? I'm a little bit scared of the word authenticity, to be honest, because it's become a buzzword. I don't know how to say this without, like, in the most genuine way, but what I'm doing, there's no gimmick to it. This is, like I said a few minutes ago, this is the best version of me that there is. This is the thing I want to be doing and the way that I feel right in the world. And there are other places and arenas and spaces and endeavors and obligations and things in my life where I, like, ugh, I have to do this thing and I don't really want to do it. But this thing, all this stuff we're talking about, this is it for me. So there's never an issue of staying authentic or not. I mean, I'm genuinely completely committed and engaged by this in a pure way that doesn't need defining.
This has been an interesting, rich, wonderful walk with you. And I think I speak for everybody when I say we were so pleased to have you speak with us today. We have a question we ask all of our guests, and so here it is for you. How can we help to support you or your work?
Oh, that's so nice. that's such a nice question. No other way. I think this call is really, you know, I appreciate the thoughtful questions and the time to talk, and that you know, you guys wanted to do that, and that, you know, for whatever reasons, and that's enough. So thank you.
Thank you, Amy.